We'll call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee to order. The hour of 2:30 p.m. having arrived March 30th, 2005. We do not have a quorum. However, we will get into the bills immediately. Just so members know, House File 1560 and House File 991 will be postponing till tomorrow. Just kidding. Representative Heigerken, you're up. If you want to give your testimony, when we do get a quorum, we will move right ahead with yours. We will go ahead and go right down the list here and start hearing bills. Representative Heigerken will move House File 1560. Representative Heigerken will have an amendment to 1560. Why don't you, if you would please, sir, describe House File 1560. Is this the one that we had heard
before
and we just laid it over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm used to have Madam Chair in education, obviously. First of all, is Mr. Schoenfield here? And he has the amendment, and I need him to clarify the amendment. So if it's possible, we can move 991 first.
Okay, like I said, we'll work on, we're not going to move anything right now, but we'll talk about 991, and then when we come back to him, we can just move him through if the committee so desires. Representative Heigerken, please describe 991.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. 991 is the tax credit E85 for dispensing equipment again. This is the first one that I had. This is the one that was introduced 3 years ago. And it's one that Representative Klinke has signed on, and he's agreed to hear it in taxes. And this bill basically would give a tax credit. Now, if you have a bill in front of you from yesterday, you had the wrong bill. There were five pages attached to it. It should be a one-page bill. Right, Sam? I think there was some extra pages.
Mr. Rankin?
Mr. Chairman and committee members and Representative Heigerken, I have no idea where those extra four or five pages came from. They should not have been part of the bill.
It would have been a very difficult time, Mr. Chair, trying to defend the Metro Council and some of the things they're doing, because that was attached to it, and I'm glad we didn't hear the bill yesterday, because there would have been some very tough questions.
Okay. I'm glad, Representative Heigerken, that you weren't defending the some of those Met Council things.
Representative Heigerken?
Thank you. But with that in mind, it basically what 991 does is gives a $20,000 tax credit for installation of the equipment, and it costs about $50,000-$60,000 to put one of those in. And this is the first bill we ran. This one would come out of very similar to yours, Representative Davids. It would come out of the general revenue, and it's a one-time tax credit. Representative Klinke signed on it. He thinks it's a good bill. So from there, I have nothing else to say. It's a very simple bill.
Representative Heigerken, I'm just going to break here a second. Is there anyone in the audience that would wish to testify against House File 991? Okay, and then we will move to 1560. We're waiting for Mr. Schoenfeld, so I guess we will lay this bill over until later this meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heigerken. And so now we'll go to House File 1743, the Blaine Bill, and members, we're going to take testimony. Excuse me, was there anyone that wished to testify against House File 1560 that's in the audience? Okay, we're going to be moving these right along. And members, I would also say, let's go to the Blaine bill. I see Mr. Schoenfeld's here. We'll go back to yours after. Well, what do you want to do, Representative Blaine? Let's go Heigerken, House File 1560. And members, what we'll be doing here is, if there's people during the regular committee time, 2:30 to 4:15, if there are folks here that have driven in on various bills, I'd like them to get a note to Craig Clark, the committee administrator, that says, I'm from more than 50 miles away, and I want to testify on House File number whatever. And we'll try and get you before the committee, because we could go for a while here tonight. Representative Heigerken? Mr. Schoenfeld? Okay, we're looking for an amendment to House File 1560. A4. Okay, Representative Heigerken, when we have a quorum, you will want the A4 amendment on House File 1560, is that correct?
Right.
Okay, so could you please describe the bill, or have Mr. Schoenfeld describe the bill, as it will be amended.
Okay. Hang on one second here. Okay. Back to House File 1560. And we had testimony to and again concerns with it last week. We did discuss the entire bill, but right now I'd like to move Amendment A4. And you should have that in front of all of you members.
Representative Heiger, we're not going to move anything right now. We don't have a quorum. Okay. But please work off the bill as if it were amended.
Basically, I can describe the amendment and then we can move it later, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. If you turn to page 2, line 5, it basically would be a change there. We would, on line 5, delete processing and marketing facilities, and we would insert activities including transportation infrastructure and the servicing of bonded indebtedness for infrastructure. That's on line 5. Sam, do you have that? Insert activities including transportation infrastructure. Okay. And the serving of bonded indebtedness. Stop word. For infrastructure. The other change would be on page 5. On line 1, catch-up should read deficiency. Line 7J, 7, 8, and 9, but delete line 7 and 8 and delete line 9 up till I, and insert in addition, the commissioner may make payments for rural economic infrastructure. It should read, in addition, the commissioner may make payments for rural economics. You delete direct and two producers. And basically, those are the changes. And with that, I'll let Mr. Schoenfield ask or answer any questions that may be.
Okay, what we're going to do, we do not have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee meeting to order, March 30th, 2005. Representative Conan moves the minutes of Tuesday, March 29th, 2005. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Now, Representative Heigerken moves House File 1560. Representative Heigerken, to get the bill in shape he'd like, moves the A4 amendment. Any questions on the A4 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the shape that the author would like. Is there anyone here that wishes to testify against House File 1560 as amended? No, we're on House File 1560. Okay, that means very brief comments, Mr. Schoenfeld.
Well, Mr. Chairman, really what the changes did was simply to open it up. There was some discussion when Representative Erdahl bill was coming through about trying to open it up so that these ethanol tails as such could be used for a variety of different kinds of things. And one of the things we were considering was that in the future there may be some things that you might want to do with bonding in order to expand the ability of using those tails to do even more for agriculture, and basically that's what this does and allows it for broader purposes.
Any questions for Mr. Schoenfeld? Hearing none, Representative Heiger can raise his motion that House File 1560 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Ag, Environment, and Natural Resources Finance Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Passed by Representative Finstead. Okay, with that, we will now go to House File 991. We've had the testimony on that. Representative Heigerken moves that House File 991 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Passes barely. Thank you, Representative Heigerken.
Thank you.
Passes with just great enthusiasm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brevity does work.
Thank you, Representative Heigerken. Okay, the Blaine bill, House File 1743. Representative Blaine moves that House File 1743 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Taxes. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I hope Representative Blaine can be as quick as I was.
Representative Heigerken, we will make every effort. And my first question, as always, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify against the Blaine bill? Okay, Representative Blaine, that means that you very briefly but thoroughly describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hyde Gerken, take notes, baby, because we're gonna show you how it's done here. Members, House File 1743 is very simplistic. Basically, we're adding four words to part of the tax exemption part of a statute. What we're doing, what House File 1743 is doing, is exempting milk and water that is vended to vending machines from being taxed. That's what we're doing.
Any questions? You've heard what he's doing? Okay, Representative Blaine moves that House File 1743 be recommended pass and sent to the committee on taxes. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Blaine.
We're on a roll here.
We're on a roll. Let's go. Okay, Representative McNamara, we'll just go down the list. If we don't have authors, we'll go to the next one. And I made the announcement, folks, that if you've driven in from some distance, we will go to your bills because we do have this room till midnight so that you don't have to stick around. You're certainly welcome to if you'd like to. Item next, House File 1857, Representative Erdahl. Your bill's up. We're going for it. House File 1857, Erdahl, licensed food handler violation penalties, applications modified. Okay, now we slow her down a little bit. Okay, so we're going to House File 1857. Representative Erdahl moves that House File 1857 be recommended passed and sent to the General Register. Are there any amendments, Representative Erdahl?
Yes, there is an amendment.
To get the bill in order you'd like, is it the 805-0380 amendment?
Yes.
Okay, this is apparently more of a substantive amendment. Could you please describe what the amendment does before we vote on it?
All right.
Well, what does the amendment do, Representative Erdahl?
What does the amendment do? It basically changes some penalty provisions from... it has to do with warnings and also with misdemeanors and changing them to gross misdemeanors.
Register. Okay, any questions on the amendment to get the bill in shape the author would like? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, you now have the bill as amended. House File 1857 has been moved to go to the General Register as amended. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify against House File 1857? Okay, Mr. Elfring, could you please state your name and who you represent for the record and give us a very concise and thorough but yet short explanation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Elfring. I'm the Director of Dairy, Food, and Meat Inspection with the Department of Agriculture. Very briefly, Mr. Chair, what this bill does is we have right now have the authority to assess administrative penalties for egregious violations of the food laws. But if we were to have companies that would violate consecutive violations, for example, five consecutive violations, and we had not caught them yet, we'd still have to warn them yet before we could assess any penalties. This would eliminate the need that we would have to have a separate warning. If they're found that they're violative, we would be able to assess an administrative penalty immediately. They would still have due process. They would still have a right to appeal the penalty. If they appeal, they would have the right to a hearing with an administrative law judge. So it doesn't eliminate any due process at all. The second part of the bill really changes some of our penalties for things like removing embargoed product or the sale of adulterated product, where we've had products that have been exposed to chemicals in a fire that have been put under embargo, have been removed and sold. Those right now are only misdemeanor charges. In fact, we had one company that moved some embargoed product that was involved in a fire. We criminally prosecuted them, and they were each fined $100. This would increase those penalties for those types of violations to gross misdemeanors. Another thing with misdemeanor penalties is after a year, they're reduced to a petty misdemeanor and then removed from the company's record or the person who violated the law.
Any questions for the department for Mr. Elfering? Representative Heigerken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alfred, are you available to do some umpiring this year? I'm looking for an umpire for Freeport Bass, which league. We'd like to have you back.
Mr. Elfring?
Mr. Chairman, I want you to know that I threw Representative Heigerken out of a few games in my career as an umpire, so I don't really believe you'd want me back.
Mr. Elfring, I would like to see anybody vote against this bill.
A follow-up.
Heigerken.
Yes, just okay, now you had mentioned earlier that if somebody had violated this, did it 5-6 times, never received a warning. Now all of a sudden, you find that this person had done it, but what happens if the person did not realize that he was or she was doing something wrong?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heigerken, we take those things into consideration, but I'll give you an example. We had a company this year who purchased grade B cream, sold it as grade A product on 5 different tanker loads. In that particular instance, they accumulated a much greater profit, and they knew that they couldn't label this product as grade A product. But yet, until we found out about it, we couldn't assess them any penalties. We had to warn them first.
Okay.
Representative Heigerken. Mr. Elfring, there's been some concern from some direct marketers. How would this affect direct marketers?
Mr. Chairman, it would not affect direct marketers really at all. And I think one of the things we have in place, policy directives, where these are just really significant violations, and people who are violating the law and intentionally know that they're violating the law. For example, we have door-to-door meat salesmen. We do not consider them to be direct marketers, but door-to-door salesmen that continue to operate without licensing, knowing they need a license, until we catch them. Again, we criminally prosecuted one. Again, very insignificant fine. We would be able to use an administrative penalty and actually have much greater deterrent out there to stop those types of operators.
Any other questions for the author or the witness? Okay, with that, I see there's no other witness. Any other questions on the bill? Okay, with that, Representative Erdahl renews his motion that House File 1857 as amended be recommended passed and sent to the General Register. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all fairs say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. We're kind of out of sync here. We got to kind of get with it here. Okay. Do we have Representative McNamara? Okay. We'll just go right down the list then. Representative Otremba, House File 1160, Pesticides Application Information Access Expanded. She has a witness here. Is there anyone that would wish to testify against this bill? Representative Otremba? Representative Otremba? We have a non-committee member here. Could we go ahead with that bill and then we'll get right into yours? Representative McNamara? We'll try to accommodate. There's a lot of bills flying around this place right now. We'll try to accommodate members that are not on the Ag Committee as we go through here. Representative McNamara, I will move House File 1937 be recommended pass and sent to the General Register. Are there any amendments?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you and appreciate you accommodating all. I know we're all on these really tough schedules.
Representative McNamara, do you have any amendments?
We do not have any amendments, Mr. Chair, and I'll defer if it's all right. I've got Gere Friso from the Department of Ag, and rather than bore you with my halfway good of a job of explaining it, I think I would defer to him to explain the bill.
Okay, what we'll do here is there anyone that wishes to testify against House File 1937? Okay, seeing no one, that means Mr. How do you pronounce your last name?
Friso.
Friso. Why don't you say so? Friso. Okay. If you could please describe briefly what this bill does, and then we'll see if there's any questions for members. And since there's no opposition, that is usually a good sign.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gere Friso. I'm the manager of the Plant Protection Section. This bill is really an update of 2 years ago. There was a major revision of our plant protection statutes, and we rewrote the Plant Pest Act and the Nursery Act. And over the last 2 years, a number of technical corrections have been found, and we've worked closely with the Minnesota Nursery Landscape Association, our Landscape Advisory Committee, and Minnesota Crop Improvement Association, and they are all in support of these technical changes. So I'll move through it fairly quickly. On page one, sections one through five are basically clarifications of definitions and also the types of directives that the commissioner can order. On page three, the definition of a tree spade operator is clarified. Also on page three, under section eight, we've clarified some nursery certificate requirements, and also the issuance of certificates is limited to persons selling nursery stock. On page four, on line five, we've clarified that the sources of purchased nursery stock need to be provided. This assists us with tracking pests that may be coming into the state. Also on page four, lines 11 through 12, we've clarified that selling certified nursery stock to uncertified dealers or growers is prohibited. On page five, there was an exemption category, which we called the hobbyists. We're clarifying that term to make it occasional sales. We've also changed the dates of sales to be 10 days for each of the exemption categories to make the two consistent with one another. On page 6, lines 1 through 15, we've added language to allow the commissioner to waive nursery stock growing site inspections under certain conditions. And those conditions are stock that will not be sold within 12 months, stock not to be moved out of Minnesota, and that the site or stock is not subject to quarantine or associated with a regulated pest. On page 7, lines 12 through 18, we've removed label requirements on nursery stock, and this is a situation in which the nursery industry told us that the labeling of actual nursery stock was really difficult for the industry to do, so we've removed that requirement and instead simply asking or requiring that the nurseries maintain records as to where the stock is coming from so that we can do tracebacks. On page 9, line 4, there is an adds a restriction on selling nursery stock to uncertified stock dealers. And then finally on page 9, section 13 regarding wildflowers, this is strictly a taxonomic correction. There's no addition or deletion of any species. It's simply correcting the taxonomy.
Any questions for Mr. Friesel? Hearing none, I will renew my... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friesel, can you still buy buckthorn at a nursery in Minnesota?
Mr. Friesel. Or Representative Macker.
No, you cannot. Representative Johnson, you cannot sell buckthorn in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, I'm so glad to hear that because I personally sawed down the one that I bought a few years ago when it was legal. So I'm glad to know we put a stop to that invasive species.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just if there is no other questions, just to sum up, the industry has worked very close with the department in developing this bill and things like that. Our concerns like that, we've worked closely, and a lot of the changes, some of them were initiated by the industry.
Representative Heigerken?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, again, does the bill itself have the Nursery Association in support of this bill?
Representative McNamara?
Yes. Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Heigerken, it does.
The one that, thank you, just to follow up here. Page 5, line 28-29. Conduct sales or distributions of nursery stock in 10 or fewer days in the calendar year was added. In other words, they don't have a problem with this, with grocery stores, et cetera, getting into their line of food. I mean, their line of business. We should say food, but apparently this is going to open it up even more for them.
Mr. Friesel? Or Representative McNamara?
Right. Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Heigerken, and I was just clarifying with Mr. Friesel, that actually was an accommodation that was made last year, Representative Heigerken, and it was not a change this year. And as in all negotiations, we're not always in 100% support of the final, but it was a compromise.
Representative Heigerken.
Yes, just to follow up, page 7, if you can get this bill through, I want to commend you, Representative McNamara, because we've been trying on the national level, trying to pass a law, countries of origin, and here you're going to do it right here. So I applaud you for it. It may be the step forward.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heigerken, the country of origin in this case is plants, not people.
Representative Heigerken.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions for the author or the witness? Hearing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1937 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all fair say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Otremba, we have House File 1160. Representative Otremba moves House File 1160 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Ag, Environment, Natural Resources Finance Committee. We have a Paul Lamont to testify, and then I do have And then a Don Gemberling for the bill, and then we do have, four, and Teresa Hill. And I believe we've got Bruce Clavin or Bill Bond to testify in opposition to the bill. Representative Trammell, if you want to present your bill, and then you will have the decision to make if you want the opponents or the proponents to go first, whatever you'd like.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a House File 1160, and basically what it does is it requires private pesticide applicators to keep records that commercial and non-commercial applicators already keep. It requires all applicators to file monthly reports with the Commissioner of Agriculture, and therefore the public will be able to see what is being sprayed where. I got involved in this issue shortly after I was elected. People were complaining about sprays. They were saying that they didn't know what to do about it. And I was pretty naive then and thinking that no big deal. I'll just call somebody and we'll be able to figure out what that is and get it taken care of. That was in 1997. It's now 2005 and some of my constituents are still asking the same questions, and so there are other states, including South Dakota, that already have an email system where you go into the system, you report what you've sprayed, etc., on the email, or you send it in, and then there's another piece of the site that you can actually go into and see which pesticides have been sprayed where. And so I'm not looking for names. I'm not looking for anything but what was sprayed and where it was sprayed. In my county, we rank 35th in the nation for cancer. And we don't know if that's what's causing it. And this would give us an opportunity to sort of follow through and figure out if it's some of these pesticides or if it's something else in our environment. So here I am again with the pesticide right to know. And I believe the page is handing out several handouts. One of them is from a constituent of mine who wanted to be here, but he's a beekeeper and he does half of his year in my district and half of his year in California. And he has some testimony. Also, the Catholic Conference.
Is that the Jeff and Christine
Anderson
letter?
Right.
Okay, members, you should have that.
It's a very good synopsis of what he's experienced as a beekeeper. The other letter that was submitted to me is from the Catholic Conference, talking about the bishop's stand on health of unborn children and stewardship of the land, etc.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to just kind of, I mean, for me, Jeff really wanted to be here, and he wasn't able to be here, and it's a great testimony because it's just one of the pieces in my district. I've actually taken a tour around several of the counties in my area, Todd County, Wadena County, Otter Tail, Stearns, Douglas, Pope, where what's happening in my area, we of course have potatoes, but we also have hybrid populars. And what's happening is they're coming in and they're buying the ag land and not selling the homestead or the woods. So people are moving into the homestead. And as I took this, it was about a 5-hour tour. As we drove along, the person who was facilitating would tell me who had cancer here. And then they would move away, and 3 years later, somebody else had cancer that was a new family. And it went on and on and on through all these counties and through all these hours. So it really begged me to know what was being sprayed. And I realized that doctors can get that information. But in my world, calling a doctor costs $150 to $200, which is an office call. And I've asked if the local deputies, law enforcement people, if they could get it, and they said they couldn't get it because they were not a doctor. So if the message is and the information is wrong, I apologize, but that's what I hear. And I still get calls all the time, and people have stopped calling, not me, but the department, because they just think nothing's going to happen anyway. And I know that some of them even have moved out of my area because of their concern and the high cancer rate. And so all I'm asking is that we do similar to, well, New Mexico, California, New York, New Jersey, Wisconsin, Montana, and South Dakota. And like I said, yesterday I even went to the website in South Dakota to see how hard it would be. I'm computer literate, but I'm not my son, who's a computer programmer. And it was quite easy, actually, to go in and type what you'd sprayed when, and then to get to the site of what was sprayed and when. So that's my bill.
Thank you, Representative Tremba. Which order would you like to go on, to the opponents or the proponents? Do you want to present your bill and then have the opponents, or would you like whatever you'd like?
We could do the people that are testifying in favor of the bill.
Okay, that's what we'll do. Okay, I have on my list, and help me out if we need someone else, Paul Lamont, and then Mr. Don Gemmerling, and then Tessa Hill. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify for House File 1160? Okay, let's start with Mr. Paul Lamont, Manager, Environmental Response and Enforcement Section, MDA. I'm sorry, Mr. Lamont, are you for or against the bill?
He's against it, but...
Well, then why don't you leave? let's go to... who do you have, Representative Tremba? You have Don Gemmerling and then Tessa Hill. Don't go too far away. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. Mr. Don Gemmerling, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Gemmerling, and I don't represent anybody except myself.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, last year you have accorded me the singular honor of a commendation on the House floor and a standing ovation for the years of my work with issues about privacy and access to government information, and this gives me an opportunity to thank some of you who were there last year for that honor. So, it also gives me an opportunity to introduce why I really am here, and that's really because of the portion of Representative Tremba's bill that focuses on opening up some very critical records for public inspection. And that's basically on the back page of the bill, the last three lines, in which current language, which classifies the information about application records as not public, would be repealed, therefore subjecting those records to the general rule in Minnesota statutes, which would make them public. One of the things I listened to and I read in some of the correspondence that was shared with me before the hearing was one of the things that I used to say privately to government entities when I worked for the government was, when you go to the legislature and make a case for information being not public, the legislature tends to be critical about that, as they ought to be,
and therefore you ought to make a very compelling case as to why certain information should not be available to the public. And depending upon the content of that information, that case becomes more and more compelling. I don't know, for example, why originally this information was classified as not public, but part of what this leads us to in looking at these issues is there clearly in this situation is distrust of what the Department of Agriculture is doing. Okay? Now, frankly, I don't know all the history of that. I just have heard it and I've read about it. And it, when you have distrust like that, part of what you need to do is open up the information that the department is involved with so that people can get a real idea of what its government, which is what the Department of Agriculture in this situation represents, is doing about a potentially serious health hazard to people. Now, you know, most of us have kids. Most of us have grandkids. In my case, I just have a new grandkid, and it renews my intensity in wanting to make sure that they are protected against hazards in the environment in every way possible, okay? And it seems to me in a situation where people are spraying pesticides, which they obviously need to do to keep our agricultural economy going, that records of that spraying, when they're shared with a government agency, ought to be open for public inspection. As Representative Otremba observed, you shouldn't have to go to your doctor and pay money to get access to a record that's been obtained by the government, okay? Now, if there's some compelling reason why these records should not be open to the public, then you ought to talk about that, and as the policymakers decide whether or not that reason is compelling enough to force people to have to hire a doctor to get records about a pesticide that may be sprayed next to their house. So, I just want to confine my comments to that part of the bill because that's the part of the bill that I probably have a better sense of what it's about and its potential impact. But I do want to emphasize that whenever the government tries to keep information from the public, that you ought to take a very hard look at why that is, what's the upside to public access, and what's the downside, and to carefully assess and make those decisions in an informed fashion. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next testifier, is Tessa Hill here? Tessa
here.
Hill, okay. Sorry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And state your name for the record.
Tessa Hill, and I represent Kids for Saving Earth and the Children's Health Environmental Coalition and Beyond Pesticides. And I have a handout here if someone would.
Okay, we will get someone to hand that out.
First, just tell you a little bit about my personal experience. I lost my son to a brain tumor in 1989. We lived in Houston, Texas, and we did a lot of quarterly spraying of pesticides in our home. I lost my husband 3.5 years later to prostate cancer. He was 48 when he died. I lost my father to pancreatic cancer a year later, and just last September I lost my mother to endometrial cancer. I also lost 6 babies prenatally, and so I had become very aware of the issues surrounding pesticides in our environment, and a lot of what I've learned is not good. I do understand that at times they are crucial. They're a life and death issue. But they're also an issue involving a great deal of pain and sorrow in terms of health and causing illness, endocrine disruptors, prenatal problems, and even death. In Houston, Texas, it's tradition to spray your home every quarter for roaches. And the pesticide companies had it set up so that when you started a new company, you had to take everything out of your cabinets and and it was really a great deal of work to get everything sprayed. And so if you didn't do that on a quarterly basis, you had to go back and take everything out. So we were being sprayed pretty heavily both inside and outside because of the fleas and that sort of thing. And I do believe that there is a connection between, and there is a proven connection between cancer and certain pesticides. And for that reason, it's really, really important. It's a first step to get records, to keep records. My problem was that when I went to the hospital and I was asked, my son obviously didn't smoke at 11 years old, but they ask you a lot of questions. They ask you a lot of genetic questions, but they don't ask you, you know, what kind of chemicals have you been around? What kinds of toxins have there been in your environment? And, of course, I wouldn't know. But now there's enough information out there where you can really go online and find out a lot about the dangers of various pesticides and various other chemicals. But if we don't have a way of determining what pesticides are being used or being sprayed, then we can't do it. So the first basic thing that we need to do, we need to have the right to be able to find out what pesticides they are. And that's a very simple step. The book that I handed out is a book that I wrote. It was sponsored by the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, APSDR. I'm on their, one of their committees. And it is a basic education book about the dangers of toxins in the environment, including pesticides. And, there's a lot of proof. We can all provide that for you at any point if you want. But the fact is the public doesn't really understand all the dangers, and they're worried more about insects than they are about their own children in some respects, because they don't know, and they need to know. And that's what we're trying to do. But it would make it much simpler if you could help us by at least allowing or giving support of this bill so that we can find out what pesticides are being sprayed. It just seems like a totally logical thing. If you have any kinds of questions, I'd be glad to answer them. I do know that there are other ways of controlling pests. I've had lots of experience with that as well. So keep that in mind. It's not the end of the world if we don't use pesticides.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Moltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Representative Otremba. I think most of the people on this committee don't view pesticides as bad. They're tools that many of the many of our constituents use to enable them to successfully make a living. And oftentimes, my in-laws, if they were to have to file a monthly report right now, they're in a trailer out calving, and so to actually come in to do that would be pretty challenging for them. Would you be amenable to a friendly amendment of, as opposed to a monthly reporting, instead having that be, say, every 6 months, biannual reporting?
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Timba,
I would be open to not having to file when there isn't a season where they're spraying or applying pesticides. I'm not sure if I have this totally correct, but in 1990, the federal Farm Bill required even private applicators to keep a record. They didn't have to send it to the department, but they're still required by law, federal law, since 1990, to keep records. So they're keeping records already.
Okay.
Representative Moll.
Thank you. Representative Trumba, granted, and they're keeping them anyway, and we know that. I wonder, I'll state my question again. Since they're keeping them, we want to know what actually is being sprayed. I mean, I represent a lake country, and it's important to, if people do have concerns about, they can access that information. I think this bill would be better for many of our constituents if they had the flexibility of only having to file those every 6 months.
Madam Chair.
Representative Trimba.
I see your point, but I live in an area where they're spraying a lot. And in order to know what you were sprayed, and waiting 6 months might be too late to do a treatment, so to speak. Can you tell me, I mean, I understand that they're calving. Are they spraying that at that time also?
But Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If they're, they probably wouldn't be spraying anything at
right.
that point in time. But maybe you can answer my question, then. If they're not spraying anything during that season, do they still have to file these reports then every month? Because they do spray sometimes.
Right, Madam Chair, I've talked about that, and since we do live in a cold weather state, I would be open to clarifying it by saying if you are spraying that month, you have to file. But if it's a time of the year where you're not spraying for pesticides anyway, they could get a hiatus for that. It only makes sense in a cold weather state. California, you know, they have to file every month, and I'm not sure if South Dakota has a hiatus time or not. I know that they are required to, but you can also mail it in. You don't have to use the computer. But I'm okay with if they're not spraying too, and then maybe when they start spraying again, or at least maybe even pre-tell them that they won't be spraying for 6 months or whatever. I don't have a problem with that because I'm all about finding out what we're spraying, and if they're not spraying, they shouldn't have to file a report or applying. I should say applying because it isn't necessarily always spraying.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Moll.
I guess Representative Tremba, sometimes I defer to my newness here. You know, 3 months ago I was teaching physical education, so procedurally, maybe you can help me out a little bit. I think this bill would be better for a lot of people here if the reporting was less frequent. Would you have any suggestions about how the bill might go forward with less frequent reporting?
Well, Representative,
Madam Chair, I believe already that they're still required to fill in the reports based on federal law. Okay. So they have to be doing that anyway. And so reporting is either mailing it in, right now it probably is mailing it in because I'm not sure if the Department of Ag has fully implemented the program that they're working on. And so timely is sometimes critical when it comes to somebody flying over, spraying, and it's your grandchild. But I don't have any problems with not filing at all if you're not applying that month.
Madam Chair.
Representative John.
To this point, I wonder if I might help with some language here. Been conferring with Mr. Rankin, and he suggested some language, help me if I miss it, that if we would turn to the back page with the item in question on page 2, line 18, language to the effect on a monthly basis or quarterly basis might be another option. During periods when spraying has occurred or spraying has pesticides have been applied. Mr. Rankin is working on this right now. Madam Chair, Representative Moe, is that getting at some of the things that you're concerned about in a way that will still satisfy the reporting concern Representative Otremba has?
Representative Moe?
Representative Johnson, yeah, I mean, that's going in the direction I think that we need to go to actually make this bill palatable to some of our ag constituents. Yeah. I guess I'd defer to Representative Otremba.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm okay with an amendment when you're not applying. Because I live in an area where there are potatoes being sprayed, there are poplars being sprayed, and it's what the crisis has been is someone gets sprayed and we have to go through a doctor to find out what's been sprayed. And if that isn't on record for 6 months, that doctor may not know how to treat that child. Do you know what I'm saying? It's a health issue. It's not. So during the application season, I can understand the monthly. But when it's not an application season, I have no problems of not having to file at all.
Representative Otremba or Representative Johnson or Representative Moe, do we have a motion to do something here to change this? Or Representative Otremba, would you wish to keep the bill in the form that you have it now?
Well, Madam Chair, I just kind of looked at this myself. Records must be filed with the commissioner on a monthly basis when actively applying. Is that okay?
Sam, can I, or Mr. Rankin?
Because I totally understand not having to file if it's...
Could you give us...
Madam Chair, there are a lot of options we could use here. One of them would be page 2, line 18, before the first period, insert within 30 days or 15 days, whatever you want, after the end of a quarter in which the applicator has applied pesticide. Or the month, you know, within 15 days at the end of a month in which the applicator has applied pesticide.
Okay, Representative Otremba, do you want to go with Council's motion, with your original motion?
Well, Madam Chair, I like
direction.
The idea of a month, and I, you know, because I live in an area that is...
Okay.
And it's something one of the first testifiers said, you know, perception is reality.
Okay.
And in my district, and I believe Representative Heidrichen and I have talked about this too in his district, perception is reality. And it takes 75 times to change a perception.
Okay.
And so
we'll go with the original language.
Well, actually, I'm okay with Mr. Rankin's inserting a month instead of if you've been applying at all. But if you haven't been applying, you don't have to report.
Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair, let's
get her down.
Let's find out. You would like to stick, Representative Otremba, with the monthly basis. How many days after the close of a month would you like to give the applicator to file this report?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Rankin,
Representative,
they would have to file monthly, period. And then if you were not applying, then you have...
Madam Chair and Representative Otremba, yes, I understand that, but the question is how long after the end of the month in which they have applied are you wanting them to get their report in? Do you want it to be on the last day of the month for that month? Do you want it to be 10 days later, 15 days?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I understand what you're saying. 10 days after the month, is that, you know, so it would still be monthly, but it would still always be 10 days after. I'm okay with any of those numbers because it still would happen monthly.
Okay.
And then if they were not applying anymore, then...
Madam Chair, then here's what I would suggest. Page 2, line 17, the last two words on the line, delete those. And page 2, line 18, the first two words on the line, delete those. And then the new language to be inserted would be within 10 days after the end of a month in which the applicator has applied pesticide.
Madam Chair, I like that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Rankin.
You are making a motion that we
I will make
that.
A motion to accept that amendment.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. So, motion prevails. I didn't get the last of that. Okay, we have some other testifiers. I don't have a list. Okay. Paul Lehman with the Department of Ag. State your name for record and begin.
Madam Chair, Paul Lehman, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I manage the Environmental Response and Enforcement Program for the Agronomy and Plant Protection Division. Quick comments. I've been indicated that time is short. The department opposes the bill. This bill is very similar to language in a bill introduced during last year's session. It greatly expands the record-keeping requirements of pesticide applicators and, to be very direct, growers in this case. Last year, we estimated that this would result in at least 4 million additional records having to be kept. Interestingly, it does not differentiate between herbicides, insecticides, rodenticides, mosquito repellents, sanitizers and disinfectants, or anything of that sort. It simply says pesticide. We prepared a fiscal note last year and offered that for us to accomplish the objectives from the department's point of view, it would cost in excess of $1.2 million the first year, $1.3 million the second year, and at least $1 million in succeeding years. And again, I would say that this year's bill's language is broader in scope, so those numbers should probably be estimated at higher levels. Enforcement-wise, there are no funds attached. This seems like a much greater intrusion into the farmer-grower environment. And without additional funding, we would need to take our available resources and divert it from our investigation programs, which you've heard a bit about, which now investigate misuse, food adulteration, and other sorts of human exposure complaints. And finally, two things. You just had a discussion about the reporting timelines. When we receive a complaint about a pesticide misuse, whether it be from a private party, a law enforcement officer, and in the last year we've assisted in several felony investigations where pesticides were used as the weapons, we respond within minutes, hours, or days. If it's a 30-day delay and a 30-day plus 10 days, it would be useless. The evidence would be cold. Our investigators would have been on the trail long before that. And finally, the pesticide data that comes from this sort of reporting, if it's collated and sort of assembled, we believe is not the best data. And in fact, in the last year, we've assembled an alternative source of data for those that think that the public's right to know is being limited. That data is available on our website and is being praised by many as being accurate and easily accessible. So that concludes my remarks. I guess I don't want to belabor this, except that I do want to make one comment about something that was entered as testimony. You have a letter authored by Mr. Jeff Anderson, private citizen, and I haven't read it. This is the first time I've seen it, but the beginning of the fourth paragraph reads, and I quote, "With no help from MDA to solve my bee mortality problem, I can put information in front of this committee that the Department of Agriculture has expended hundreds of inspector hours and thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of laboratory resources directly trying to find out what ails Mr. Anderson's bees." So I bring that to your attention, that that statement is patently offensive.
And thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Lehman? Representative Heigerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you ever, Mr. Lamont, did you ever receive a complaint from the Gray Eagle area, I think would perhaps be half in Representative Trimble's district and half in mine, on the spraying of poplar trees? in that particular area in the last couple of years.
Madam Chair, representatives, we have indeed received many complaints in that general area and have performed numerous investigations.
Follow up.
You found nothing?
Madam Chair, representative, in some cases we found that pesticides had drifted and had caused damage. In some cases we found that a quote-unquote benign type pesticide, a biological BT, had been used and could not have been responsible for the toxicity and the mortalities reported. In other cases, we found that no pesticides had been applied at all. So we found a variety of results from the investigations.
Madam Chair, you know, I don't know who Mr. Anderson is, but I do have bee operators in my district, and I have, you know, of all of the sprays that are done, and I have a very large ag district, none have affected bee colonies such as the poplar trees. Whatever they're using, it's not just Mr. Anderson. I've got a couple other bee people that have hives that make a living on it. And they all complained about this spray that they use in poplar, because apparently bees do love poplar, and they do go in there. And I've had one of them up from Holding Fork told me that he lost about half of his hives, about half of his bees after they went into this area. But a lot of them have gone away from the area because of that. They stay away. But something is telling me, and Representative Trump, I know where you're going with this bill. I think the intent is good. I think it's perhaps a little expansive. I'm a little bit worried about we're spraying for corn, or we're spraying for soybean, we're spraying for pulp, or we're spraying for oats and everything else, and all of these are being lumped in, and they're not creating a problem. But we do have a problem area, Mr. Lamont. And I did ask last year and the year before the Department of Agriculture if they would give me a report, if possible, of you know, some of the studies that you have found, some of the results that you have found from that particular area, because I do have the same complaints coming into my office as Representative Tremba does, and it all has to do with this particular area, this particular spray used exclusively on poplar. No other problems, no other cases in the 3 years that I've been in office. So again, I renewed that request. That there must be something, I still find that there must be something in this spray that they're using with the poplars that is used just for that and nothing else. Comments?
Madam Chair and Representative, I would be less than candid to say that the problem that you're describing has stymied everyone involved.
Okay.
But I would also be candid to tell you that the department, as I indicated, has responded on perhaps dozens of occasions to complaints, has performed professional investigations, has utilized some of the best technical technology available, laboratory technology, and our results have been inconclusive at best. In fact, our entire case files have been turned over to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, to the parts of that agency that perform the evaluations on the safety, hazards, toxicity of pesticides. And we have said, please examine this particular product, the one that you mentioned, because we have not established a cause and effect.
Thank you. Representative Heiger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So did you test the dead bees? Was there any conclusive studies from that, or did you just test the product in itself to see if it was...
Madam Chair, the Representative, in many instances we tested dead bees, mortalities, we tested pollen, we tested other media available to us. Curiously, in most cases we did find positive findings and fairly substantial findings for another type of pesticide that beekeepers themselves use in their own pest control. So we did not find that association between the carbaryl product that you speak of that's being used on occasion in the hybrid poplars and the mortalities. again, I would be very frank with you that that was the target, and we could not find the cause and effect.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Welty, do you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the testifier, you had stated that you have information on your website that's very acceptable, or accessible, I should say, and that you have had compliments on the accessibility. What information were you specifically talking about that's posted on the website?
Madam Chair, Representative, in fact, I just before I came over here today, I went to our website, and of course you know that you kind of click down through, but if you go to the home site for MDA, under water and land and ask for more, and then what you get is 2003 pesticide usage on major Minnesota crops, and then this is the lead page of what I believe is either a 47 or longer page report that does report on the statistics that I mentioned, and this report was prepared in partnership between our department and the Minnesota Ag Statistics Service. And although I wasn't personally involved in this, I couldn't help but overhear people complimenting the data as being useful and accurate.
Follow-up, Representative Welty.
Follow-up, yes, thank you. And does that information come from the commercial applicators? Or where do you gather the information for your statistics to publish?
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not know, but I do know that it's a multi-faceted gathering mechanism, and that it's regarded as more comprehensive and more accurate than the records that are subject of this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry, Representative Conan. I knew.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A comment and a question for both Representative Otremba and the department. I went up into that area and saw what was being discussed up there, and there's a lot of support for this bill in that area. If you go down into my home area, there's just about nobody wants this. What I got out of the tour I took up there was that the problem seemed to start with the spraying of the trees, both with the beehives and with health problems. My question to both of you is, could this bill apply to the problem area and leave the rest of the state out of it?
Either Representative Otremba or Mr. Lamont respond to that?
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's happening. The research shows, and after we did a press conference not too long ago, I got calls from all over the state saying, because it was called the Pesticide Right to Know, and they were saying, why shouldn't we find out what's spraying? We're not asking for the person. We're asking for what has been sprayed. And this only applies to licensed applicators. And the 1990 Federal Farm Bill already requires licensed applicators, including private licensed applicators, to keep track of what they're spraying, or applying, I should say. So that is already in federal law that they have to do that. All we're really looking for is to have a mechanism in the Department of Ag that can be similar to South Dakota, where you either email it in or you send it in. And my son's a programmer, and some of this stuff automatically goes into pieces where you just look at what's been sprayed where. And it's like, I don't know if this is the cause and effect, and I don't know if the cancer piece in southwestern Minnesota has to do with pesticides or water or air or what. But we've got to get a handle on some of this. I'm a cancer survivor. My husband died of cancer. I mean, my senator has cancer. I mean, help me, you know? And if there's nothing wrong, if there's nothing there, if you're not afraid of anything, why can't we just do this? I mean, if we can save one, I mean, we know we have you know, horses are boarding, dogs are boarding. We have a small child who has webbed hands and feet. They all live in that area and are in one of those houses that it's surrounded by the poplar trees. I mean, it's pretty... I probably go to a funeral a week for somebody that's died of cancer. And I don't think that... I mean, I think there's other areas where this is happening, and no, because we have this popular situation, it's brought to a higher level, but you talk to people who are in a potato area or whatever, and I just don't understand why just collecting that information when most of the other states already do this, and I believe the federal government is even working with the Minnesota Department of Ag on trying to do more of this on an electronic basis, that you want to call us a pilot project, I'm sure we'd take it.
Mr. Lamont, do you know how many other states are doing this?
Madam Chair...
Or Representative Trimba, maybe you know, too.
Well, I don't know the exact number. We were pulling up a bunch of them, and I just, you know, I know that South Dakota, and I visited their site yesterday and went through it pretty thoroughly and was impressed. But we know that California is, New Mexico, Arizona, New York, New Jersey, Wisconsin is working on this same type of bill, Montana. That's as far as I got. I thought, you know, I know that there's a lot of them, and I just wanted to pick out a few. And I wanted to pick out some big states and some small states who are doing it. And I don't know. We all know about fiscal notes. We're not naive here to know what, you know, fiscal notes can say what you want them to say. I've been here long enough to know that.
Mr. Lamont, did you have a response to that, too? I'm sorry if I cut you off.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't have information gathered and with me, but I do know that the state of California has a comprehensive use reporting system.
They have most everything in California.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And beyond California, I am not aware of any state that has a comprehensive system. I know South Dakota piloted one recently. Mm-hmm. I also know that the state of Oregon, about 4 or 5 years ago, passed a law requiring one, and they quickly ran out of money, and it has been stalled ever since. Okay. So they found it to be a very resource-intensive endeavor.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I just want to say one more thing. I know that the department is putting together a database for beekeepers, and I'm just wondering if we could piggyback on some of that. I didn't see a fiscal note for that, and I don't know what that is, but maybe we could piggyback on that and start in some of a slow start, but piggyback as long as they're working on a database for beekeepers.
And they are paying a fee, an apiary fee, for that. The beekeepers are...
Madam Chair, maybe we could take some of those other fees that we're charging and apply it to that.
We have one more testifier. If we could get Mr. Bruce Clavin up here. And maybe we have more, but I have him down. Yeah, well, I'm going to get this testifier up here.
Madam Chair, for the record, Bruce Clavin, I drew the short straw amongst my colleagues, and they nominated me to talk for all of them. I'll tell you for the record that the groups I have involved in this issue are the wheat growers, the barley growers, all three sugar companies, the potato growers, and the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives, which would be a commercial applicator association. I've also carrying the message for the Farm Bureau, the corn growers, the soybean growers, crop production retailers, and the agricultural. And if Mr. Lamont mentioned that you don't distinguish between insecticides, we might pick up all the livestock groups, too, if they're out spraying for flies in the barn. They might also be interested in this as well. It's been a difficult issue. This will be the fourth year on this subject matter about the disclosure of the records. While trying to get at the issues that Representative Trimba continually raises about the bees, the poplars, and the cancer issues. The bill, for my members, we haven't talked about wheat or corn or any of those other things today, but those would all be subject to this. And all of your growers and all of your districts would have to send these records in. It's been talked about today about the records being kept, and she's right, the federal government requires the keeping of the record. Probably a better way to think about that is what you do with your taxes, and we all pay taxes here, everybody in the room. We got to keep our records for the IRS. We don't send them in to Washington, D.C. We keep files and bank statements and all that stuff in case there's an audit. In case there's trouble, in case there's an incident, you've got something to prove. The federal government requires that you keep those. The federal government requires that we keep these. But we don't send them in. We have them in case Mr. Lamont's people get a complaint and come out and do an investigation. So if you think about it more as an IRS record than some kind of a disclosure requirement on the part of the growers, that might help. Mr. Gemmerling was noting about that on the very issue about the government, this being government data, and you've got to make the case. We just did that earlier today on animal ID in another room, making the case for keeping those private. This isn't government data. This is kept on our farms, like I mentioned, in case there's a problem. It's not government data. So it's not something that's either hidden or made public or private. It's something that's kept in our shop or wherever we keep them. It's not government data to be public. Another point we would make is there seems to be some angst here, especially in Representative Terms District, about the communication with neighbors, that they couldn't find out what it was, that there was some frustration with that. I started spraying for my dad in ninth grade. I started working for him in seventh grade, cultivating primarily. You go up and down the field all day long. When a car drives by, it piques your interest. When the car stops on the township road and someone gets out, you're really interested. You think, who's that then? And you want to, you know, who's coming out to see me? If I was out spraying and someone came up with a rash or sick child and they said, the kids rode their bike by here, were you spraying? And I would, not only would I ask him to take me up to the shop, I'd drive the kid to the doctor and pay for the visit myself. That's what would happen at our place. There seems to be some trouble with the communication there, but the broad brush in bringing all the rest of us into that concerns our members, and they have policy, and we've discussed this at our annual meetings. It was also mentioned that comparing to other industries, there's a chart back here. It wasn't displayed. I've seen it before at the press conference. It shows a power plant or some kind of factory, wastewater treatment plants, emitting things 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, possibly. You might spray your wheat once on a Wednesday afternoon in June. Not 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you think about that application more like the Wagner power painter on your house, a nozzle shooting out a mist, we don't require people to disclose when they painted their house and keep a record of that. And the spraying, in our view, would be similar. It would be a similar analogy versus some kind of factory. And so we would have you think about that as well. Our interest, to conclude, members, is being able to use our crop protection products that are approved by the EPA, and you had a couple of days of this last week on EPA and so forth and those other issues, that we spend a lot of money for and don't take lightly because they cost a lot of money. It's a crop protection product that we need to use on our farms, and we're concerned about environmental groups and others trying to reduce that or shut that down under a database, and that's where our real concern lies with the broad reach of the bill, but still trying to be sensitive to the particular points being raised with poplars, bees, and cancer. And I know there's been some discussion about could be limited, and maybe that should be a discussion. But my members will leave that message with you.
Madam Chair, I have a question. Mr. Clavin, DEET is a known endocrine disruptor. Could this be general enough, then, that if I want to spray some, keep my granddaughter from getting encephalitis at night and she's at our place and mosquitoes, I would have to report or keep a record of spraying
Madam Chair, it's licensed applicators.
Yeah, but I'm a licensed applicator.
Okay, but it's pretty specific here at what parts of things that you can spray.
But, you know, that is a known endocrine.
But are you a commercial and a non-commercial?
I'm private.
Yeah, so now that you don't have to.
Yeah, now, but with this, it includes private.
No, the private, yeah.
I mean, I just want to make sure, because we do stupid things here.
And another thing, one of the reasons, Madam Chair and Mr. Clavin, these are absent landlords. That's the problem. Our neighbors are very good at sharing what they're spraying. These are all absent landlords, and that's a huge problem, major problem.
We have some questions. Also, can we get those Representative Welty? Did you have one? No, Magnus.
I did, Madam Chair, and
you forgot it.
Have you seen this, Representative McKenzie, have you seen this in today's information we got today?
Yes, and if you look at the date, it was done last year.
How many?
And it, most of that, what's in there, has been disputed.
Okay.
I don't have the reaction to that, but I'll say it again on record. I'm a legislator. I have 36,000 constituents. I'm sorry if I hurt their feelings when I told them that we were having trouble with getting records, but I have to represent 36,000 people in my district whose perception about the Department of Ag becomes reality. And I told them to please come out in my district and undo that. It takes 75 times to change somebody's first impression. And that's what that's all about.
I can appreciate this. I got the DNR in our district. Anyway,
well, Madam Chair, I was told by many colleagues that take it as a badge of honor.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Are there any other questions? Do we have any other testifiers? Do you have any other testifiers?
No, Madam Chair, we're fine.
Okay. So, Representative Otremba renews her motion. To pass the ag.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Okay. To Ag, Environment, Natural Resources, Finance Committee. And you'll take the roll.
David?
No.
Blaine? Finstead?
No.
Hamilton?
No.
Heidgerken?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Junkie? Coonan?
No.
Magnus?
No.
Moe?
Yes.
Otremba?
Yes.
Pennis?
No.
Erdahl?
No.
Welty?
No.
There being 9 nays and 3 ayes, the motion does not prevail. This is a coloring book?
No.
Okay. Item next, Representative Hansen. Now, members, please follow me here on this because we're going to try to make some accommodations for Representative Hansen here. Representative Hansen has a bill that has to do with the grass bank buffer zone drainage requirement extended to ditches. And if the page, Jennifer, if you could please hand out an amendment. Now, there were several amendments going around. None of them met the 24-hour rule. But as far as I'm aware, all interested parties have come to an agreement on basically making this bill a study. And so in talking to representatives from Farm Bureau, other ag groups, really had no problems with doing this. I would ask and pass the amendment out. If members could please take a look at the amendment. And then I'll let you know what I would propose to do with the support of the committee members. And I would also ask, I haven't talked to Farmers Union or Land Stewardship or some of those folks, but I would ask the question, is there anyone, if this bill is amended and we waive the 24-hour rule, that would be opposed to the bill as amended? Okay, then what I would propose to do is I will move House File 1019. I will now ask for a vote on the waiver of the 24-hour rule. Is there any discussion on waiving the 24-hour rule? I'm going to ask that we waive the 24-hour rule on the AO5-0416 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye for getting rid of the 24-hour rule. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I will now move the AO5-0416 amendment. That is basically turns it into a study. Any discussion from members on the amendment? We'll get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Mr. Chairman, I think there might be a couple.
Mr. Magnus?
I think there might be a couple word changes in here if I'm correct.
I think you're right. Thank you, Representative Magnus. Let's pass the amendment, then we'll go to amend the amendment.
Okay.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Rankin, I believe we need to change a couple words. So now we have the bill is amended, House File 1019. What do we need to do, Mr. Rankin?
Mr. Chair, I am seeing this for the first time right now. You perhaps know
okay.
Where the amendment should be.
Mr. Rankin, I have absolutely no clue. Mr. Hansen, Representative Hansen, could you please give me the amendment you'd like me to offer?
It would be on line 12, the words of one assessment. Strike those.
So it would read then, the board shall report the results to the Senate and House Representative Committees. Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Rankin. So I will move that on line 12 we delete the words of one assessment. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hansen, we now have the bill in the shape you would like it. Would you like to make any comments on what we're doing here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank members of the committee for the indulgence of the 24-hour waiver. In your packet, there's a large amount of information and material relating to the ditch buffer bill, House File 1019, which passed out of environment. The bill, as it stands in front of you now, is a study that would need to go to the Ag and Environment Finance Committee next. I've spent the last number of days working closely with affected parties. Some of them, I believe, are still in the room to try to come up with a solution to the bill that was 1019. And we came to that compromise within the last hour, so that's where we're at. What the bill does now is it has the Board of Water and Soil Resources conduct an implementation assessment of the buffers, their use, maintenance, and benefit. It does this in consultation with farm groups, watershed districts, soil and water districts, county and conservation organization, and also make sure that federal agencies that have buffer programs are involved in that and reports back next spring. And so this is to gather more information. What we found as we were trying to move forward with House File 1019 prior to this was that there was a lot of questions about what exactly was current law, how things could be interpreted. And so what we're trying to do here is to gather facts. The model that we're looking at was something that occurred, my understanding, the last session where the Department of Transportation had there were similar issues raised about road ditch habitat, and they did a study during the interim and came back with a report. So I would, if Mr. Raddatz or Mr. Schoenfeld are here, just if folks need that comfort level of hearing that they were involved in this compromise.
I think we're okay. From what I understand, I think we're okay, but for the record, they're supporting this. Okay, any questions of the author? With that, I'll ask the question again. As amended, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill, House File 1019, as amended? Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know this is going to Ag Environment Finance, but it seems to me that there would be a fiscal note now with this study. So between now and then.
Right. Representative Hansen.
Yes, we would have to look at that. Mr. Harnack was involved in some of these discussions. If he's still here.
That's okay.
Representative Pennis?
Yeah.
Okay, because that would be the next stop. Yeah. Any other questions for the author?
Scott.
Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I just want to say thank you for working with farm groups and everything on this. That's it. I just want to say thank you. I know I had some concerns initially, and thanks for addressing those.
Any other questions for the author of Fem Penis?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I truly believe in buffers, and we need to preserve our farmland. No one knows it better than the farmers. However, I get real concerned when we dictate the size of the buffer, and one rod times a half a mile is 1 acre, and then when we I hope that this study will tell us how many acres of farmland we're going to be losing. And if we need 300 feet of buffer, great, we should do it. If we need 2 feet, that's what should be done. But thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the author?
2 rods is 2 buffer. 2 rods is 2 acres.
Okay, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1019... be recommended pass as amended. Be recommended pass and sent to the Ag, Environment, and Natural Resources Finance Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you.
Okay, item next. Otremba, property tax class rate reduced for certain property bordering public waters. Representative Otremba? Okay, we will go to... item next. We'll come back to Otremba after the next bill, if she's here. A Conan bill, Clara City Rail Container Loadout Facility Study Required. We have a Gene Winstrom and a Rick Lyseth that are here, and a Dan Fury. Dan Fury goes down to your teeth. Okay. Okay. So we have a Gene Winstrom and Rich Lyseth. Is there anyone in the audience that would wish to testify against? Representative Conan, both of these gentlemen are in support of the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, is there anyone that wishes to testify against this bill? You know what that means, Representative Conan?
Gene Winstrom isn't here also, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, so he cut it down by 50%.
Right.
Okay. Okay. You're very good, Representative Conan. Okay. With that, if you could please state, or Representative Conan, please present your bill.
Okay. What the bill is a study for a rail container loadout facility in Clara City, and the study would be done by the Commissioner of Agriculture along with the Commissioner of Transportation. And I have with me today Rich Lyseth, his manager of the elevator at Clara City, and he'll give you a little more detail on what Clara City's been working on.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Coonan moves House File 1942 be recommended pass and sent to the Ag, Environment, Natural Resources Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record and what we're trying to do here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rich Lyseth. I am representing the Clara City Farmers Elevator today as manager. And what we are currently looking at, briefly a quick background of what our co-op does. We are a bulk grain shipper, 110 car shipper on the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. And we currently ship most of our bulk commodities, corn and soybeans, to the Pacific Rim countries. What this has to do with a container loading facility, basically we'd be looking at egg products, which there is an abundant source of egg products in our 50-mile radius, being ethanol, sugar co-ops, or excuse me, not ethanol, DDGs, dried distillers grains, that go on these containers to ship to the Pacific Rim countries on Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. Our location, if you're not familiar with it, we are at the intersection of Highway 7 and 23, two major intersections in the state that would allow very good truck traffic to come into that facility to bring containers in. I guess the other thing I just wanted to reiterate is that this is for ag products, and the ethanol industry is growing very aggressively in our area. In that sense, since we have the infrastructure largely in place already, we would like to participate in this study.
Okay, thank you, sir. When you say you're moving agricultural commodities, I'm kind of your value-added guy, and you mentioned DDGs. What percentage would you say right now, if this was built, would go out as some value-added process versus just shipping out corn or shipping out soybeans?
right now, if you look at ethanol as it's processed, there's 55% of that corn kernel is actually a dry distiller's grain.
So well, I'm saying that's value added. I'm saying what is value added versus just shipping out corn that hasn't been processed in any way, shape, or form.
Well, currently, value added would be one that would add value to the ethanol industry, that they now have another market for their DDGs.
Right, but what I'm saying is, how much of it is value added products that you'd be shipping out versus just shipping out a load of corn that the farmer brings in?
Mr. Chairman, that quantity is unidentified today, and we hope this study would help quantify those numbers.
Mr. To that point, Representative Magnus.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would just assume, looking at a container facility, you'd be looking at probably shipping identity preserved products. It'd be a higher value, certainly a higher value than that. Otherwise, you would just use a bulk grain shipment. So, we're looking at containers. We're looking at very high value products for a specialty market.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Magnus. Representative Birdall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Coonan, is this the same project that, with respect to Representative Junkie, Wilmer is also looking at doing?
Representative Coonan?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, yes, it is. What we're attempting to do here today is have Clara City included in that same study.
Representative Erdahl?
Good luck, Representative Coonan.
Representative Coonan, how far away... This is kind of interesting to me. How far away is Clara City from Wilmer? Because, you know, we had the bill that Ripson Junkie had. How far apart are you?
Clara City is about 18 miles from Wilmer.
So Wilmer is a suburb of Clara City.
There you go.
Okay, we just want to get it said right here. Okay. Any questions of members for Ripson Coonan? If not, Ripson Coonan renews his motion that House File 1942, there's no amendments, were there?
Nope.
House File 1942 be recommended pass the Subcommittee on Ag, Environment, and Natural Resources Finance. Any other questions for members? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Coonan, and thank you, Mr. Lysak. Okay. Item next, we'll go to the Otremba bill. Oh, that's for 1620. Okay. Where'd my list go? Oh. Okay, Representative Otremba has a treat for the committee. They are... For me. They are deluxe whole milk chocolate-covered macadamias. Now let's see how this bill goes. If you want to pass it around. Oh,
hey.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
Mr. Okay. Chair, I toured a plantation when I went to my son's wedding and brought you back a treat.
Thank you very much. Very good. I have lost my agenda. Mm-hmm. Craig, where's my agenda?
Mm-hmm. I don't know where you put it.
I got it.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Otremba moves.
I forgot.
That House File 1797 be recommended passed and sent to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Otremba, I'll ask the question, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify against House File 1797? Okay, Representative Otremba, could you please describe your bill for
this? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, I call it the Blue Waters Bill. It's similar to the Green Acres legislation. Basically, what's happening is farms that are near lakes or bodies of water are having their classification changed from agricultural to seasonal rec. And so... what this does is allow you to apply for this blue water status, and if you decide to take it out at some point and develop it, you have to pay back, I believe, about, is it seven years of taxes, tax breaks that you have gotten.
Okay, any questions for Representative Otremba? Representative Otremba, I would just say that... I think this is a very, very good bill, and it rights something that has gone wrong. And thanks for the treat. That's really nice. With that, any other comments on House File or questions on House File 1797? What we're doing is we're changing it so that she told you what we're doing. Representative Tremble moves that House File 1797 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
I guess they work.
I guess I'll have to go back to Maui and get some more.
Yep, like I say, here today and gone to Maui. Okay. Okay, with that, we will go to item next, House File 1620. Representative Coonan moves that House File 1620 be recommended, passed, and sent to the General Register. Okay. We have two groups of folks here. We have a Jim Johnson and a Jay Wood. Is there anyone else for proponents, Representative Coonan, that we have? A Dan Fury, a Pam Letson, and then Gene Leisman. Okay, Representative Coonan, if you could describe what your bill does, and then I would also ask, then we have some folks wish to testify against the bill. Which order? I usually, whatever order you want as far as proponents or opponents, will take your lead, Representative Coonan.
Okay, see, I have an amendment I would like to...
Okay, Representative Coonan has an amendment to House File 1620. Do we have the amendment?
The E1 amendment.
It's here. E1.
Okay, the E1 amendment, and I would suggest that the committee allow the author to get the bill in the shape that he would like. So, Representative Coonan moves the H1620DE1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the, to delete all. So we'll be working off the DE1 amendment, which is now House File 1620. Welcome to the committee. If you could please... present your bill, and then we'll go into testimony, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry.
We'll be working off the delete all amendment now, and what that does is allow persons who aren't veterinarians to float horse teeth. That person would be required to get a license and would have to be able to prove that they either took training from the Equine Dentistry Association or had been practicing dentistry 3 out of the last 5 years before enactment. And the board may require an appropriate fee for this license. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think we can go ahead and take testimony.
Thank you, Representative Coonan. Would you like to bring forth the opponents or proponents?
Let's start with opponents, then we'll go to proponents.
Okay, so we will go with Dr. John King, and then Dr. Tom Haggerty, and then Dr. Julia Wilson. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify against the bill? So we will go with the opponents first, and members, which would be the Dr. John King, Dr. Tom Haggerty, Dr. Okay. Julia Wilson, and then we'll go to the proponents, which we have listed. Okay, where's Jennifer? Well, we'll get them passed around here. Okay, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. John King, Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. I'm here today to serve as a resource for the committee and to bring to your attention some concerns that the Board of Veterinary Medicine has regarding the language in House File 1620. I'm not here to speak as an opponent or proponent per se, but to bring to your attention issues that the Board of Veterinary Medicine feels need to be addressed.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
The Board of Veterinary Medicine was established in 1893 by the Minnesota Legislature to regulate the practice of veterinary medicine and to act as a steward of the statutes. that govern veterinary medicine. The purpose and the mission of the Board of Veterinary Medicine is to ensure persons licensed to practice veterinary medicine in Minnesota have met educational requirements and to practice veterinary medicine, that are licensed to practice veterinary medicine, and to respond to complaints and concerns from the public regarding competency, standard of care, consumer fraud, and quackery. The language in House File 1620, with as amended, with the kind of grandfathering clause in, would allow nearly anyone to float horses' teeth, irregardless of training, qualifications, skills, or ability, or motive. As one board member of the Board of Veterinary Medicine said, it would allow nearly anybody to pick up a 2-foot carbide tip medical instrument, shove it in a horse's mouth, and do anything they want with it. It needs to be pointed out that floating horse's teeth is part of a comprehensive oral exam of the horse, and not just the simple taking off of enamel points, as some people might think. Identification of points, hooks, ramps, wave mouth, diseased teeth, abscess teeth, removal of teeth, and observation of the oral cavity and identification of pathology and disease are components of equine dentistry and floating teeth. Diagnosis of some major equine diseases and reportable diseases may be determined by this oral exam. For instance, reportable diseases, state and federal reportable diseases, such as equine infectious anemia or Coggins diseases, is commonly known, may be spread by the instruments of teeth floating. A horse may be dropping grain and chewing abnormally because it has enamel points on its teeth, but it also may be doing so because the horse has open oral vesicles and lesions due to vesicular stomatitis or slobbering because it has rabies, not just because it has a bad tooth. The performance of equine dental procedures sets the stage for a very real possibility of injury to the horse, the handler, or the person performing the procedure, as anyone that has done these procedures can attest to. The most gifted horse person or horseman or horsewoman has no way of predicting the certainty of how a horse will respond when a float or other medical instrument is inserted in its mouth. As anyone in this room that has worked with horses can attest to, things can go wrong. A horse can blow up, and injuries do happen to horses and humans alike. House File 1620 does not require any liability insurance to be carried on behalf of the horse floater, as is customary in veterinary medicine. What can happen is the horse is injured, and the person can just leave and go on to the next appointment. Many horse owners will say that their horses are insured, and many of them are. They are high-value animals, especially many of these warm bloods are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars investment. Things must be noted is that equine insurance, nearly all policies are for loss of life policies. They do not address loss of function. They do not address major medical. Okay? These things, if the horse is injured, the responsibility will be left upon the horse owner. And that's something that needs to be remembered. People may want others to float horses' teeth that are not veterinarians. And that is debatable. But if the animal is injured significantly and is taken out of competition, is not able to perform, someone is going to be expected to pay for something. House File 1620 implies that floating in equine dentistry is a non-invasive procedure, and this is simply not the case. Floating a horse's teeth and equine dentistry and an oral exam is a medical procedure that involves diagnosis, treatment, therapy, and at times, surgical intervention. A simple floating routinely may result in oral or gingival bleeding. Simple floating can often lead to the diagnosis and treatment and the need for advanced dental care that a non-veterinarian equine dentist is not trained to identify and cannot correct. Horses may continue to live with painful oral conditions that the horse owner may not even be made aware of. Horse owners may be left with a false sense of security that an equine dentist has taken care of their horse's mouth. It should be noted that current state law already allows for non-veterinarians to float horses' teeth under the supervision of a veterinarian. That provides for all the things that meet the mission of the Board of Veterinary Medicine, which is accountability and safety for the animal and the person providing the services. In this bill, there is still no definition of what floating a horse is. It says it allows for handheld tooth rasps and files. Many, many dental procedures in horses is carried out with a motorized Dremel tool, a Makita Sawzall with a reciprocating blade. Okay, those would be arguably handheld. And it is simply not in the best interest of anyone to put those type of instruments in a non-sedated horse's mouth. That's a prescription for disaster in the opinion of the Board of Veterinary Medicine. It should also be noted that nearly all of the states include veterinary medicine in their practice act, Veterinary Practice Act, and many of them are more restrictive. They do not even allow the practice of equine teeth floating under the supervision of a veterinarian. Some things that need to be addressed, that the Board of Veterinary Medicine needs to be addressed in the even amended motion or amended bill is the term equine dentistry. It probably is not appropriate. The term of dentist, doctor, nurse implies training, implies competency and proficiency and certain accountability. The accountability may be addressed in this amendment, but it gives the false impression of ability, and the dental profession may not appreciate that. Equine teeth floater, non-veterinarian, equine teeth floater may be more appropriate. Also in this amendment, it has requirement for submission of rules to the leaders of the House and Senate to look at that. That is already part of the rulemaking process. Rules have to be submitted to the governor's office before they're put out for adoption and discussion. The Board of Veterinary Medicine does not work in a clandestine fashion to formulate rules to oppress individuals that are licensed or non-individuals. So that would be probably a redundant feature. The health licensing boards, of which the Board of Veterinary Medicine is one of, has been directed by Department of Finance and the legislature that all licensing fees need to be addressed in statute, not rule. So that's something that needs to be addressed in here and has not been discussed. Also, in adopting this bill, it would be in essence creating another licensing division. Okay, we're licensing a group of individuals that have unknown numbers. We don't know who they are, and there's no central database to go to. It's going to require some funding to gather names and educate horse floaters that they need to register or license. And that's an important aspect. The Board of Veterinary Medicine is operating under 2002 budget recommendations as given by the governor through 2007. To put this additional financial burden on the backs of veterinarians is probably not the most responsible thing to do. Also, the scope of practice, which I addressed earlier, isn't fully defined, and that needs to be looked at. The Board of Veterinary Medicine, if it's wishes of the legislature to do this, to allow this of non-veterinarian teeth floaters, we're happy to work with the authors, but as it is, there are some glaring holes in the proposed language in the opinion of the Board of Veterinary Medicine. The proposed language in House File 1620 does not address the issues that are part of the core mission of the Board of Veterinary Medicine, and that's protection of the public through regulation of practitioners and the assurance of competency, standard of care, and the well-being of the animal. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. And just for the record, we do need to clear up the record on some of your testimony here that it was just outlandish. You said that the Board of Veterinary Medicine was the steward of the statute. I think everyone on this committee knows that the steward of the statute is Mr. Sam Rankin. Okay, so with that, Representative Erdahl.
I apologize for that, Mr. Chairman.
Apology accepted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, what percent, say there are 100 horses, how many of those would need equine dental care?
Equine dental care, Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I apologize. Equine dental care is becoming more and more to the forefront in equine owners and equine practitioners. There is a lot that needs to be done to horses' mouth. Historically, horses' teeth were floated when they were dropping grain or they're 20 years old. It is clear through studies that teeth floating should be, or horses' teeth should be examined as young as a yearling horse, and certainly by the age of two. Whether floating needs to be done or removal of caps, which are teeth that are stuck on top of the new one that's coming in, is a issue. All horses would benefit to some degree of floating or equine dentistry. I can't tell you that it's 100%. I can't tell you that it's 2, but a very significant amount of horses would benefit from equine dentistry and horse floating.
Mr. Chairman. Doctor, you mentioned that under current law, this is provided for under the supervision of a veterinarian. The term under supervision is kind of amorphous. How direct a supervision? What does
Mr.
that
Chairman,
mean?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, the supervision is defined in the rule of the Board of Veterinary Medicine, and it's defined simply as close physical proximity to the individual. The thing that may be unique in veterinary medicine is the only licensed accountable individual in veterinary medicine is the veterinarian. Okay, there are not licensed technicians, there are not nurses as in human medicine and human fields. So that allows for a veterinarian to delegate tasks to one of his bona fide employees or an individual that they may perform procedures that they are capable of doing that is not violating the practice of veterinary medicine, such as surgery or diagnosis. So that will allow a veterinary technician to clean a dog or a cat's teeth, or even an equine dental technician to work on a horse's mouth, which there currently is in Minnesota, okay, under the supervision of a veterinarian, close physical proximity.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you.
Oh.
Well, close proximity. Does that mean within sight? Does it mean on the same farm?
Dr. King? I apologize. Mr.
True.
Chairman, I know I'll be kicked out soon. Representative Erdahl, it defines as close physical proximity in the same premise.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering if you have similar concerns, Dr. King, for example, with a farrier. Someone dealing with the hooves and, you know, diseases there.
Mr. King? Dr. King?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl. That isn't something that has come before the Board of Veterinary Medicine. It isn't something that we're really looking at. And some may compare the two as equal. The fact is that it's not equal. A horse owner can look at the job that was done by the farrier. They'll know if the feet are uneven. They will know when the horse is limping the next day. They will be able to more easily assess competency of that individual. On the other hand, someone that has a horse owner that has their horse's teeth floated, I would venture to say that none or very, very few reach into that horse's mouth, grab that horse's tongue, look into that horse's mouth with a flashlight to observe all the dentistry or all the dental arcanes. Okay? And it's something that's just not done. So it's one of those hidden or blind, and I'm not saying it in a derogatory way, but it's in one of those things that cannot be assessed readily by the horse owner. They had someone out. They had someone stick a float in the mouth. They assume that things are well, and they may not be. They do not directly, rarely do they directly assess the ability of the practitioner. They say, well, the horse may be better, or the horse doesn't throw its head, and that may be due to the dentistry or the practice that was done, but it may be due to several other reasons, too.
Two more quick questions. I got a pony when I was 5, Mr. Chairman. I'm into this. Dr. King, I was told by my senator that a compromise was being reached on this. Is this amendment any part of a compromise? Have they worked with the Board of Veterinary Medicine at all on trying to work out something?
Mr. King?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl. There has been some discussion, but it's been pretty unilateral. Here, this is what we propose. What do you think? The Board of this was one of the first volleys. And again, we said, you know, we're moving in the right direction, but it's not addressing some of these things that are important in public policy. There's been another amendment proposed. I have met with Senate counsel, and that's where it's coming from, to help draft some changes that address some of these issues. But it has not been reviewed by the Board of Veterinary Medicine yet, nor the authors in the House or the Senate. We were directed to and will work with something that meets needs if that's what we have to do. But, you know, it needs to be a little cleaner and better defined than what the current bill gives.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. One more. Representative Kuhn, perhaps you could answer what they are required to have a license under the amendment. You know what the fee for that license would be?
No, according to the language in this, the fee would be set by the board.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. To that point, Representative Pennis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Since there's a fee in here, and I think the testifier alluded to the costs, did you not? That there would be costs involved. Mr. Chair, would this not have to go to Environment Natural Resource? Thank you, Sam. Next, and so is there a possibility of getting some of this covered? I want to compliment the author. I think you've done a great job since the original. but evidently we didn't cover, or you didn't cover everything.
Representative Kuhn, when this comes up for a vote, and we're a little ways away from that, I think, but when it does come up for a vote, we probably should, I had said general register, probably finance, and that's okay as far as deadlines, because it can sit there for whenever.
Mr. Chair, that's okay with me, too.
Representative Pennis?
That'd be great.
Okay. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Dr. King. Do veterinarians hold the equivalent of medical malpractice insurance?
Dr. King?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finstead, yes, we do carry insurance. It's expensive. It's not required, just like I do not believe that it's required in medical practice, although I'm not sure, but it is standard for the industry. If an animal is injured through malpractice or incompetency, the insurance helps pay for that.
Representative Finstead?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that answers my question somewhat. I'm just thinking, personally, my wife and I own horses, and we've put, in my estimation, too much money towards them. But it's a pretty big investment, and if we go down this road and I mistakenly, because I don't, my wife takes care of this, but if I mistakenly say, oh, here's the teeth need to be floated, I call the guy that's floating teeth. He comes in, wrecks the teeth, the horse dies because it can't eat, or whatever happens long term. Does the insurance cover it? Who's liable? I mean, that's the kind of questions I have. Is that off base or not, in your estimation?
Representative Finn said that would that'd be the wrong coverage.
Well, I think we would it be Vet Med Mal or
no? I sell for Norwegian Mutual. We sell my fault insurance.
My fault, yeah. Well, Finn too is very Norwegian, yeah. So yeah.
To the question on the insurance, Dr. King.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finstead, veterinarians typically carry malpractice and liability insurance that provides for if there's a death, if there's an injury, that the insurance will pay for that. It also provides for if the individual that is holding the animal, restraining the animal, which is typically in the horse floating, or in the horse industry, the horse owner, it also provides for if that individual is hurt, that there is coverage for that.
That's good to know. Representative Kuna, do you have testifiers, you know, some of these people that are just doing the floating of the teeth?
Yeah.
Okay, then I'll wait for them.
Okay, any other questions for Dr. King? Okay, then we'll go. Thank you, Dr. King.
Thank you.
We'll now go to Dr. Tom Haggerty, Chair, Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Haggerty. I'm a veterinarian, and I'm representing the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. We have 1,600 veterinarians in Minnesota belonging to this association. I'm chair of the Government Relations Committee. We have taken this issue up both with our committee and then with our executive board. We are strongly opposed to this particular legislation. We do not think it's necessary. The present law allows for non-licensed people to float horses' teeth under the supervision of a veterinarian. We think that this works very well. We do that with cats and dogs. We have certified technicians that do teeth cleaning on dogs and cats and do that under the supervision of the veterinarian. We think that this proposal becomes very cumbersome, becomes expensive to handle it, and we simply do not think it's necessary. As you're well aware, the bar for the standards of care for animals today is constantly being raised. The public expects more and more of how everyone treats animals, and certainly that's expected of veterinarians or of people that are doing procedures on animals. In the days when I got out of vet school and went to work as a practitioner, it was not uncommon for lay people to do particular procedures on animals, on cattle particularly. But those days are long gone. That just isn't done anymore. That's past. And today the standards of care, what we expect, is much greater. Incidentally, Ag and Growth Council is not here, but they too have taken the same position we have, which is opposition to this particular bill.
Dr. Haggerty, is that to the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, I cannot say to the bill as amended.
Okay, because we're working out the DE1 amendment.
So okay, I cannot say that, Mr. Chair. Okay. Appreciate that.
And I think we need to know that here,
sure,
as far as the bill is amended down the road here. So, please continue.
Yes, and I'll only continue to say that horses are very valuable both emotionally and monetarily, and that the best standards of care are expected of them, and I would hope that cost would not be the factor over the health of the animal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Haggerty. Any questions for Dr. Haggerty? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, sir. Okay, Dr. Julia Wilson, President, Minnesota Association of Equine Practitioners. And I believe you have a 3-minute video.
I want some popcorn. Grab that horse.
Last time we talked about some of these old fillings that are been there a long time.
When you have a toothache or need a checkup, you naturally go to a professional, your dentist. Veterinarians who receive extensive training in equine healthcare, anatomy, and dentistry offer virtually the same services. It's just that their patients are a little larger. Horses need regular dental exams as a part of their overall care. A good dental health can help prolong a horse's life and usefulness. To understand why it's so important that a horse get proper dental care from a qualified professional, consider the makeup of a horse's mouth. Horses have unequal rows of teeth, and the chewing surfaces have very little overlap. When eating, a horse doesn't chew in an up-and-down motion like a human. Horses have to chew sideways, and then can only chew on one side of their mouth at a time. Now, this motion causes the teeth to wear down unevenly, with sharp points developing on the tooth surface. These points, if not taken care of, can tear into the soft tissue of a horse's cheek, causing a lot of discomfort. A thorough exam can find uneven wear, but also a host of other dental abnormalities that affect the horse, things like excessive transverse ridges, hooks, ramps, tall molars, wave mouth, as well as fractured or chipped teeth. A good dental exam can also pinpoint periodontal disease and can offer the veterinarian clues to other serious conditions, like oral tumors. And dental problems can also be symptoms of infectious disease, so it's important an equine practitioner trained to recognize all these problems conducts the exam. Equine dentistry includes an array of tools. Now, this is called a hand float. It's a kind of a rasp, and it's used to file down the sharp points on the tooth. You will hear veterinary professionals talk about floating a horse's teeth. Now, the term comes from carpentry, and it means to smooth or level. The procedure looks something like this. Filing the sharp points in this manner doesn't hurt the horse. It is, however, sometimes very difficult to tell whether the job is getting done properly.
When you're doing it in this manner, there's no direct visualization, so it's all by feel. Because I can't see anything in her mouth, so this is all blind floating.
This is something called a full mouth speculum. It looks frightening, but it's used to keep the horse's mouth open during an exam. And when dental work is being done in the hands of a professional, it is a humane tool.
What we're doing is looking inside the mouth, trying to find out what she's got for abnormalities in her mouth.
Some horses will stand still for the exam and for floating, but many will not. If they're frightened, horses have a very strong instinct to fight or flee.
Good girl.
When dealing with a horse that weighs anywhere from 900 to 1,500 pounds or more, it's important to conduct examinations and procedures on a calm, quiet animal. That's why sedation is important. Trained veterinarians understand that a sedated horse is less of a danger to itself and to the human handlers, including the vet. A mild tranquilizer helps make the horse comfortable and helps lessen any pain the animal may be feeling. It's something similar to what your dentist would do for you. A sedated horse allows the veterinarian to conduct a safer, more comprehensive exam. And as it turns out, this horse has a typically human problem.
See, she's got a cavity right there.
Proper sedation also allows for more thorough work to be done in the close quarters of a horse's mouth. Motorized power dental tools like this are very safe in the hands of professionals. They allow a veterinarian to quickly, carefully, and completely file down sharp points on a tooth. It's a new technique that's being used with greater frequency, and the results are much more effective. The actual procedure can take up to 45 minutes to an hour when properly done. The result? Quality dental work. It doesn't matter whether it's a top-level show horse or a backyard friend. First-rate dental care from a professional veterinarian is an important key for a healthy and happy horse, now and in years to come.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Wilson, would you like to present your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Julia Wilson, and I'm here representing the Equine Veterinarians of Minnesota. I'm president of our organization. I'm also a faculty member of the University of Minnesota and responsible for the dental training of our veterinary students that are emerging from our curriculum, and I'm very proud of that fact. And I'd like to echo what Dr. Haggerty said about the standard of care changing. Equine dentistry is a very exciting field to be involved with right now. We are learning an awful lot about it, and it really is much more complex than simply floating teeth. I hope you were able to notice that the horse wasn't exactly thrilled with having its mouth examined in our little video presentation. So I'm also here representing the horse's point of view. None of us like going to the dentist, and certainly having these kind of procedures done with sedation, which must be given by a veterinarian, is the much more preferable and humane way to do things, in my opinion, never mind the fact that we can do a much more thorough job. So as a representative of the Minnesota Association of Equine Practitioners, we are very much opposed to this language, including the amendment, for the reasons that Dr. King stated, as well as for the welfare of the horse.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Any questions for Dr. Wilson? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony and your video. Okay, we will now go. Was there anyone else that wished to testify against the bill? Okay, we'll now go into proponents. In the order I have is I have Jim Johnson, Jay Wood, Dan Fury, Gene Leisman, and Pat Letzel. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm from Sacred Heart, Minnesota, and I'm here representing a few hundred horse owners in the state. And I'll just read a few words that I've written here. My name is Jim Johnson. I'm from Sacred Heart, Minnesota. I've been working on teeth in Minnesota for about 15 years. In October of last year, the state ordered me to quit because I was not a veterinarian. I then informed my clients I had no choice but what to quit. In response to that, my clients and a large number of other horse owners made it clear that they wanted a change in the statutes in order to be free to choose who they could and could not hire to provide simple services like floating teeth. I agreed to see what I could do and contacted my senator, Senator Coogley, and Representative Lyle Coonan. We agreed on a wording and this legislation was introduced. We are asking that non-invasive floating of teeth and equines be exempt from veterinary medicine. I would compare it to be no more of an invasive procedure than dehorning cattle and goats or castrating cattle, swine, goats, and sheep, which are exempt now. Farrier work, which is probably the most important part of a horse, is also exempt, and rightfully so. All these procedures are very important to the animals, but should not be controlled by veterinarians only. I am here today on behalf of hundreds of horse owners and stable owners to urge you to support this measure and allow for the freedom to choose these services. This is not meant to be in competition against veterinarians. There are not enough practitioners to serve the horses in this state, and if this is left to only vets, there will be many horses that are forced to go without any care. I thank the committee for allowing time to hear this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
I will next go to Jay Wood, horse trainer, stable owner. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Wood. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jay Wood. I reside in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and I have a farm located southwest of the Twin Cities in Plato. Beautiful small town, if any of you have ever been there. I train 30 head of horses. They're American saddlebred show horses. We also have some hackney ponies. Our primary business with the horses is training young show horses, from yearlings, two-year-olds, three-year-olds, and on up to some age show horses, as well as my wife and I have a handful of broodmares that are getting to the older age group now, the 15, 18-year-old bracket. This issue is an issue that really is a deep-hearted issue for me, as two of my main clients are veterinarians. So you can imagine where I sit on the fence, wanting to be able to continue to keep my clients as veterinarians, but also service the needs of my horses the best way possible. Everybody has a specialty. I'm not going to call just some guy off the street to come in and tube worm my horse or vaccinate him or treat him for colic. I'm not going to come call some guy in off the street to float my horse's teeth. I'm a professional horse trainer. I get paid a lot of money, sometimes not enough, to do my job. The horses that are entrusted to me, I pick out the individuals that can do the very best job. The people that specialize in that sort of thing, horseshoers, veterinarians, and people that specialize in doing teeth, or chiropractic work, massage therapy, all the different facets to go into the high standard of care that Dr. Haggerty talked about. He's exactly right. It is a high standard of care. Right now, people are competing in all different facets of the horse business and wanting to do the best, whether it's at your local county fair horse show or up to the World Championship Saddlebred horse shows that we go to. So the standard of care has got to be there. The contrary to what Dr. King had stated on a few things, we do keep insurance on 90% of all of our show horses. The horses that are owned by other clients, I strongly encourage them to insure their horses. Some people are in the financial category that they can afford to take a loss on their horse, whether it be a $10,000 horse or a $100,000 horse. Those that are not in that position, they have mortality insurance, they have major medical insurance, and they also have loss of use insurance. And I believe the veterinarians are aware of what those different insurances are and how that sort of thing works. The other issue that really gets at me is how it all of a sudden becomes such a huge thing the vets want to dive into. I can go to United Vet in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, a veterinarian supply company that sells to the general public, as well as any one of you, and go and buy two different sets of dental floats. And I can go home and I can float my horse's teeth this afternoon if I want. Am I going to do as good a job as some of those people that go to Barnes and that's all they do? I've had, over the last 10 years, three different people come to my barn to do teeth. Two of them have been from outstate, one from Illinois, one from Kentucky. They have never questioned whatsoever what the different licensings are or if there was a veterinarian on the farm, and there never has been. And I've also used a fellow here, the fellow just spoke, Mr. Johnson. And in all the years that Mr. Johnson has done my teeth, and I really love the video that I assume the university produced. I would like to think that I helped pay for that with all the horses I've had there at different points in time. So it was a very nice video. There was a piece of equipment used in that. In all the years I've seen different dentists work at my barn, one thing that the equine dentist gentlemen will use is, they'll never use rather, is the speculum. Because they have always led me to believe that that is a very dangerous piece of equipment. As you can see that, they had that horse in the video in stocks, so it couldn't move side to side. It could go up and over backwards and injure itself, or it could just try to stay there and stay frightened. And they put this huge piece of metal in its mouth, and they force it open with the locking device to hold the horse's mouth open so that they can get their instruments in there. You also saw that they had another halter on the horse, tying the horse's head above its head to this metal bar that's cemented into the ground, holding it there. Now, if that's not invasive, I don't know what is. And then you saw the colleague of the veterinarian holding the horse's head, and the vet using two hands on the float. The different men I've had at my place to use the dental floats, they've used just the floats. I've never seen them use that cool little mirror. That's a cool little thing. I'm being facetious there. They have always just used the floats. One hand on the float, steadying the head. The gentlemen that do this type of work, and I'm sure there are others that don't do as good a job, they are more what I would like to think of as a horse whisperer. They go in there in a calm fashion. They take their time. Never before have I had to have two people holding the horse, one holding and the fellow trying to do the teeth. Never before. In the years that Mr. Johnson has done work at my place, we have one horse that we have ever medicated. Mr. Johnson doesn't carry medication to medicate him. The vet tells me medication to have on my farm to use to medicate my horse. If I want to tranquilize him, use the same medication they used on the video. Am I breaking the law? I might be, I don't know. But it was sold to me. I tranquilized the horse, and that's the way that it works. My customers know it. And the people that own horses, They're not naive. They didn't just fall off the truck last night. They know who can do the best job. If the veterinarian can do the best job, they're going to have the veterinarian. And if that's who they feel comfortable with, that's great. If it's the next person they feel comfortable with, an individual that all they do is teeth, then that's who they're going to have to use. We shouldn't have to regulate that sort of thing. And I want to be able to have the right to choose. And that's what it boils down to. Contrary to Dr. King's comments on the farriers, yes, most horse people can look at the feet and say, wow, that foot looks good. When they've got the pad on, they've wrapped it all nice, and they've got the shoe, and everything looks good. But how do they know if they've got hoof wall separation, they've got white line disease, if they've got thrush? You can't see that unless you look at it. So, you know, the farriers, maybe that's the next issue. If this isn't allowed to go through, you know, this is an important thing to give the horse owner the right to choose and have the specialist come and do what they need to do. And I don't believe that the way the bill is written right now, I think it's great. I think that the people that want to continue to do this above board will go and work with the veterinarians, take their licensing test, pay their fees, and everybody will move on and we'll hold hands and sing kumbaya. Thank you for your time.
Any questions? I do have a question. Where's Plato from Clara City?
Plato, now, I'm disappointed, Mr. Chairman, you're not familiar with Plato. Plato's southwest of the Twin Cities, right between Glencoe and Norwood Young America.
That's right. Oh, okay. Well, see, I'm down by the Wisconsin-Iowa border, so I don't get this about as far as I get away
you
from
don't
home.
Do the
folks such as Mr. Johnson or others that are doing this, do they carry insurance? Is there some insurance policy they can carry in case something goes wrong?
I'm not an expert, Mr. Chairman, on insurance, but I'm not stressed if they do. I've got insurance on my own horses.
Would that cover it if he messed up?
I believe it would. If he messes up, that's the chance we take. No different than the horseshoer messing up. And the malpractice insurance, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we had a horse that got sent to the vet hospital, not the university, but a different one, to get ready for the breeding season. And the first procedure we did to her after we kind of checked her out and ultrasounded her and so on was to give her a shot to induce her cycle. And it ruptured her uterus and she died. Did we go back to the veterinarian and say, we need to be paid for this horse? No. That horse died as a direct result from the shot that it was given. Granted, it was hours later, but that's what the cause was. And that was determined, you know, post-op. I mean, we just didn't do that. I'm sorry, I've been around horses for 30 years, and I've never seen one get injured from the floats.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Wood?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Excuse me. Next, Mr. Dan Fury from Pine City. Can you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and then present your testimony?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dan Fury. I'm from Pine City, Minnesota. I'm a horse owner, and I show horses along with my wife and my daughter, and we have for quite a few years, and I've been directly related with horses for my whole life. I pretty much echo everything that the other gentleman has said so far. And I would like to add that the devices used by the vets, the apparatus, the electric sanders, I would never have any of my horses subjected to that, especially under medication. Some of my horses are worth in excess of $30,000, and one slip with those automatic tools and the show season's over. And when a horse is under medication, sedated, doped up, there's no one that can communicate with that horse. And you might ask, you know, communicate, but a good horse person can read a horse. If there is a problem with an individual tooth, that dentist who's good, the guys that I know, there's about four or five of them that are just regular tooth floaters. They can spot a tooth just by the reaction of the horse. Well, if that horse is medicated, the ink and react. Another thing is I kind of researched it a little bit, and last hearing I had asked a couple of the vets what kind of training they get in veterinary school. In addition to their regular schooling, they get 40 hours of dentistry. Well, sorry. If they come to my farm with 40 hours of dentistry and expect to work on my horses, it's not going to happen. I need people with experience. For the last 15 years, me and my family have intensified our horse showing, so we've acquired more or less a team. We've got trainers, we've got our vets, massage therapists, farriers, nutritionists, and yeah, dentists. So when our horse isn't moving right or something's wrong with our horse, we have our team to diagnose the whole thing. So it's experience, and I've been a contractor for 30 years, and in those 30 years I've known that when you find the right people to do the right job and you delegate the responsibility to them, everything goes smoothly. So I think we should get this bill moved forward, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Fury? I have one quick question. I need to straighten this out. Under current law today, you as an owner, can you float your own horse's teeth?
Sure.
You can do your own. Okay. Okay, next person, Gene Leistman.
Litchfield?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Welcome to the committee. Gene, if you'd like to state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Gene Lissman. I own and operate a horse training and breeding facility with generally 75 or more horses.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have some petitions to present, but first of all, I wanted to just mention a couple things. I did make some phone calls to some animal insurance companies asking what the difference would be if something should go wrong, if a veterinarian had done a procedure or if a non-veterinarian dentist had done a procedure. And I was told by several companies that it would be a case-by-case situation, and in either case you would have to prove neglect. And if neglect was not proven, that they would pay a claim for major medical. So I don't really think that that's as much of an issue, as some might think. I also wanted to say that I applaud our universities for teaching more comprehensive dental procedures. One vet that we use, who I love dearly, who is 50 plus years old and a wonderful equine veterinarian, I asked her how much schooling she had in dentistry in vet school, and she told me 5 minutes. So I'm glad they're doing better now, but there's a lot of veterinarians out there who don't have much experience. I have some petitions here, some hard copy petitions that were just basically asking that people who want to express their support for the proposed amendment removing the practice of equine dentistry from the purview of veterinary medicine. It also says we in no way wish to imply that the equine veterinarian does not have an important role in the care of our horses, but rather that we would prefer the opportunity to choose who we use without interference. And this is an internet petition saying the same thing with 240 signatures and many, many comments. People who have had wonderful experiences with non-veterinary practitioners, dentists, and some who have had not so good experiences with veterinarians, for example. It's been my experience having used both equine dentists and veterinary practitioners, including those at the U of M, that for dental care, that the specialized work performed by the equine dentist is far superior to that performed as an add-on service by a veterinarian. The equine dentist generally possesses advanced education in this very specialized field, something that many veterinarians do not have. Anyway, there's pages of comments and signatures that I would like to give to the proper person.
If the page could get those up to us, sir.
Sure. And so in my opinion, I would much prefer to use my equine dentist who has 15 years of experience compared to my veterinarian who I love who's had 5 minutes of training in dental work. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Thank you very much. And our final, is there anyone else? I've got one more person here, and then I'll open up if there's anyone else wish to testify for or against. Okay, Pam, is it Latson or L-A-T-S-O-N? Okay, that's an N, not a W. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Pam Latson. I'm from Moose Lake, Minnesota. I own a small training lesson facility in Moose Lake called Kindred Spirits Farm. I am also a certified equine touch practitioner. As a certified equine touch practitioner, part of the schooling that I underwent in my training was time on equine dentistry. I in no way, shape, or form profess to have enough knowledge to go out and perform equine dentistry, but we spent an extended amount of time looking at teeth, jaws, from horses that had passed away. So I have a fairly good understanding of the things that were presented in the video, the maladies that can happen in a horse's mouth. I have used vets to pull out my horse's teeth. I have had them put in stocks with the speculum put in. I've had dentists come to my farm that don't use those devices. I've had vets come to my farm that use different devices. I've had horses tranquilized, and I had them work on, well, they were not tranquilized. And my experience has been that my preference, unless there is a major problem that would require surgery, I would far prefer to have a certified equine dentist or someone like Jim come with the experience. There's something to that, developing the relationship with the horse and that softness and quietness. That's just magical. And watching Jim work, as I have over a number of years, he's the best I've seen. I had a horse that I had hauled to Stillwater that they put enough tranquilizer. They told me to put down an elephant, and the horse was still fighting in the stocks, and they had a heck of a time getting his teeth done. And Jim came in and worked on that horse, no tranquilizer, nothing, and got the job done just miraculously. I get a little bit concerned that if we start legislating and telling people who can come and work on their animals, my career is going to be on the line. I'm going to be told you cannot go and do your equine touch practice. My husband's a farrier. He might be told, unless you have a veterinarian board or if you have a prescription by a veterinarian telling you exactly how to do it, he's not going to be able to trim our horse's feet. I think we as owners have the right to choose, and we need to have the right to choose. And I think people are becoming more and more educated in the care of their animals. And they're going to learn. There are going to be your flukes out there that shouldn't have a float in their hand, but they'll be on that farm once and maybe in that horse's mouth 5 minutes and they'll be asked to leave. But I have the right to choose. I think that's the bottom line here. So I thank you for your time.
So, Ms. Latson, you're pro-choice on this issue?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Latson? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Representative Coonan renews his motion that House File 1620 is amended to be recommended passed and sent to the Committee on Ag and Natural Resources, Ag and Environment, Natural Resources, Finance. Any further discussion from members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, so it goes to Ag Finance. Thank you very much, Representative Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Okay, Representative Junkie moves House File 1453 be recommended pass and sent to the committee on taxes. Representative Junkie, first I'll ask the question, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify against House File 1453? You know what that means, Representative Junkie?
I still have to go to Krenke's committee.
Okay, that's the bad. That's the good news is nobody's opposed to it. The bad news is it's got another stop.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Representative Magnus takes special note. You should be very familiar with this bill.
Representative Magnus, and
by the way, Representative Magnus, Mr. Chair, and everyone else in this committee, there's lots of room for co-authors on this too.
I remember
Representative Magnus
praising the tax bill when I was doing it.
Mr. Chair, I was on
Magnus.
Mr. Chair, moving on. Mr. Chair, House File 1453 is modeled after the Jobs E program. However, and I came to this observation after driving around the country for the last year and thinking about the Jobs E program, and Mr. Chair, thinking about another group of businesses out there that we have called farms. And we all have lots of these small businesses in our district, and the problem we have is that while all other businesses are able to pick up and move into the new Job Z zone, we can't move that Job Z zone over to our small businesses, the farms, who are unable to move. They're locked in where they're at. What this bill simply does, members, is creates a new what we call Farm Z, F-A-R-M-Z, and it basically gives the same Job Z status to anyone who starts a value-added, Mr. Chair, your middle name, value-added facility on their farm. What might we be talking about? Someone starting a cheese plant. Someone starting a bottle milking operation. Something I'm near and dear to, maybe someone starting a pickle operation. Anything you can think of that would add value to your product, you ought to be able to build that facility on your farm utilizing your products that you produce and get the same benefits as a Job Z zone elsewhere. That's pretty simple, members. There's some stipulations, just like the Job Z program, on a number of employees. We actually make it tougher. I believe Representative Magnus, your bill had a 20% increase. We make it 25% for farms. We need to invest at least 10% of a gross year's income in it, and obviously it has to be reviewed by deed, and they're the ones that authorize it and get all the paperwork done. That's what this simply says. I did also provide an article that was written in the Agri News out of Rochester where they talk about this bill. It was introduced last year, which was obviously late after the budget year, knowing that we'd have to come back this year probably with it. But members, I think it's a good idea. I think it's something that its time has come, and it's a way, again, I think, to bring jobs, opportunity, and income to our farms all across the state if they have a desire to do so. And Mr. Chair, what can I ask? I will not yield to my roommate, Representative Rubina.
I want to know if it has to be built prevailing wage.
Representative Junkie?
Whatever, Mr. Chair, whatever the current law is for Job Z.
Well, Mr. Chair, no, that is, an interpretation is an interpretation by the AG, but we're doing that. I just came to see if what my roommate does down here, Mr. Chair. I had some free time, and he does a very nice job, and I just wondering if he was my DD for tonight.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. And that was a guest appearance by Representative Rukavina. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I stand for any questions. I think it's pretty straightforward. I don't know who'd be against this. Obviously, it'll cost some money. We don't have a fiscal note yet. Who knows how many folks we'd have? I think a prime example, this is a botting facility. I think a lot of us are aware of it. It's down by New Prague or La Center or somewhere where a farmer had the same idea. He went to get some, he wanted to do organic milk. He decided to go check with the big bottlers and see if they'd bottle it and distribute it for him. By the time he was done, there was no profit. He said, why don't I do it myself and put it together? And I think he's employing 50 or 60 people driving trucks over the Twin Cities and south of the cities now. And I think we have potential to grow a lot of these on the farm, maybe starting with a small two-person cheese plant, but who knows where we go from there, Mr. Chair. And you live close to Wisconsin. I think you understand some of the Wisconsin on-farm businesses that are there with the milk industry and then the cheese and the other things. And well, why not Minnesota?
Representative Jenkins, you've got a great bill here. I have a constituent that has a dairy farm and has just put a whole bottling plant right on the farm and really could have used something like
yep.
this. Does this take away any local control?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe so.
Good, then I'm for it. Okay, with that, members, Representative Junkie renews his motion to House File 1453. We recommend it pass and send to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Next meeting Tuesday. Thank you, Representative Junkie. Next meeting Tuesday. We'll have a few bills on there, and then that's it until... the first deadline, I mean, that'll be the first deadline, will be the next day, I think, or is it that day?
It's that day.
Is the deadline.
Tuesday midnight.
And then we'll come back in the next week or so and do the Senate files and then go through the whole process. So that good government all the time, we are adjourned.